Hi everybody, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carroll. Welcome you to the weekly podcast from the Banter team. One of our favourite conversations at last month's Banter weekend at Other Voices in Dingle, County Kerry was with Jean Curran. Jean is the Waterford-born photographic artist and photojournalist, and she joined us by the fire in Foxy John's as Storm Desmond raged outside. She talked to us about her From Both Sides collection, involving portraits of US military in Afghanistan, which were then painted by hand by an Afghan artist, as well as Neither Here Nor There, about young middle-class Malawian students moving to Ireland, and The Shoreline Cast, focusing on fishermen working from a deserted beach in Kenya. Hi everybody, welcome back to Banter here at Foxy John's. We already had two great performances today, two great musical performances, but our first conversation today is with the Waterford-born photographic artist and photojournalist, Jean Curran. Please give her a big round of applause.
Hi.
Hi. Let's go back to Waterford. Let's start off in Waterford. When you were growing up, did you want to be a photographer?
No.
Okay, what did you want to be when you were growing up? Don't say a vet.
No, I didn't want to be a vet. But I was interested in painting and I was interested in colour. And I didn't have, I suppose, any real discipline and I was a bit wild. So the idea of actually doing anything other than getting out and seeing the world was really like not... I never thought about going to college. I never thought about anything like that. All I wanted to do was go and travel, see the world. And growing up on a farm like I did, I was just imagined that the world was such a bigger place than the world I knew. So that was it.
Yeah, but it's amazing though. Like, I mean, the more you travel though, you realise all those other worlds that exist in your farmland as well.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
Well, like, I mean, when you were growing up, I mean, you know, I'm not going to presumptuous kind of like to say what decade it was, but like, I'm kind of wondering about what part photographs played in your family, you know? But like, I mean, when you, like, you know, I know at home, like when I was home in Tipperary recently, there was a young shoebox in the sitting room full of old photographs.
Yeah.
Did that play a part? Was something similar with your family?
Yeah, I was interested in images. And I was interested in the image, but I mean, like, there was nobody, you know, my father was a farmer, my mother was a chemistry teacher. There was nobody that was kind of going, oh, let's explore your creative talent or your creative side. You know, you don't go into a convent primary school. And I got into trouble in school and I had to move to a boarding school and it was 4 years of just waiting to leave. And everybody else seemed to be kind of like getting on with their lives and kind of knew what they wanted to do. And all I wanted to do was go to Africa. That's all I wanted to do. And I was really, really interested in the images that were coming out of Africa and that I saw. And I definitely remember a very poignant time in kind of the 90s when the Gulf War started and seeing the burning oil fields and feeling like, oh my God, the world, this is, you know, the end is nigh, this is the end. And being kind of, being very moved by that, but at the same time, always being interested in Africa, looking at Africa and feeling like there was a massive misrepresentation there.
Yeah.
That how horrible it was to always have the same image of the same kind of people, same children, and how dehumanizing it must be for parents to have their children used in that way to generate money for aid and NGO organizations or to be the face of a conflict. And had anybody asked their permission? So I was asking myself all those questions at a very young age and then I just really wanted to go out and explore it.
That's really interesting because, I mean, like, I mean, when you started working in Afghanistan, and we come to that in a bit, I mean, you were kind of, you've kind of said in interviews about how the narrative is kind of exploited, you know? And, like, I mean, you obviously taught the same thing at a young age about how the African image is really used.
Definitely, yeah. And, I mean, you open up a newspaper and you open up a newspaper now looking at the refugee crisis, all the images come from the exact same place. They're all of, you know, orange life jackets strewn along the coastlines of Greece, you know, hundreds of people walking in one direction towards us. It's us as the white Europeans and seeing people that don't speak our language, are not the same colour, are not the same, you know, creed walking towards us. And it creates an element of fear, you know, that, oh my God, we're being taken over. There's like, you know, but that's what it does, and it's all, but all the images are taken from the exact same place.
Yeah.
And so...
So, like, I mean, can you remember, like, I mean, Jean, what images of Africa stuck with you, apart from the ones that are being used to kind of, like, I suppose, generate funds? I mean, was there any photographer that you can look back on now who was doing things? Was it press photographers? Was it like that?
I don't think I really started to know about photography. When I left school, I went travelling on my own for 2.5 years until my mother dragged me back from Canada and made me study advertising and marketing and public relations, and I did that unwillingly for 2 years in Cork, and all the time I kept on going, why am I doing this? And it just didn't make any sense to me. And but I do remember when I was in sixth year going down to the career guidance teacher, who was Sister Teresa, and going down to Sister Teresa and saying that I was interested in doing photography, and Sister Teresa said, opened up, we used to have these like journals, and it said all the points that the from the CEO that were from the previous year, and it said something like 670 points. And she was like, "How many past subjects are you doing?" And I was like, "2." And she's like, "You'll never get 670 points." She's like, "Here's a form for nursing. Just fill that out." And like, that was my career guidance, you know. And so, yeah.
Okay, so after basically you signed in, like made the world of PR and advertising could do without you. At what stage did you start picking up
a course? I heard about a course in Cork in St. John's College, and literally I'd never even heard of like a PLC course or like, you know, if I knew that there was like an art portfolio course you could do in Waterford that you did to get into art college, but I wasn't interested in doing that. And I'd come back from my travels and I was very, you know, I'd meet all these people from lots of different, you know, areas of the world, and I just wanted to know about their lives and like, how did they make their money? Where did they go to school? Did they go to college? You know, all these kind of like just random things that you're interested in. And I heard about this course and I signed up and I got in and I started it. And that was the first time I was ever really exposed to like proper photography. But prior to that, I would definitely kind of cut out pictures that I saw in the newspaper that maybe interested me somewhat. And I kind of just collect images, you know, didn't really know what I was doing either.
Okay, how long does the course last?
That was 2 years.
Okay, so at the end of the 2 years, you have a fair idea then that like of what area of photography you want to pursue.
Well, after the first year, I went in on the first day of the second year and I went up to my tutor and I went, "I'm going to go to Africa this year." And he was like, "Best of luck to you, Gene." And and then I started fundraising. I started looking for money everywhere. I begged, borrowed, stole, like, and I got enough money together to go to Malawi, really interestingly, to a place called the Billy Reardon Memorial Trust in Malawi on Cape McClure that was set up by Mags Reardon, who's from Dingle. Right? And so I went out there for a month and I was in this little village and I just documented what was happening in the village. And I made two bodies of work. I made one in black and white that was more kind of like, I suppose, considered portraits that were, you know, taken along the beach, and they were very beautiful. I look back on it now and I go, my God, I was way better than I ever like realized I was. And if I'd only had some confidence in it, you know, would have been great. But and then I made a color, some 35mm color film work, and put a little book together about like what daily life was like. And that's what I was interested in. It was just actually finding out what reality was like rather than these like, you know, very sensationalized depictions of Africa.
Yeah, okay. So like after like, I mean, you returned to Malawi later on in Ireland, you know, with a follow-up project.
Yeah.
So after kind of coming back, we'll get that in a minute, but after coming back from Malawi, like did you know instantly you were going to go somewhere else? And was there other areas of Africa you were keen to explore?
Yes and no, but I didn't really have access to them. And I also needed to, I kind of felt like, oh, everyone else is kind of finishing their degree and getting along. And I was very fortunate. I just no sooner finished college and I got a job as a trainee photojournalist down in Cork. So I started working for the Evening Echo and doing some work for the Irish Examiner. And I sat on the sideline of many a soggy GAA pitch somewhere in Cork on a Friday evening while there was 14-year-olds kicking around a ball. And I was like taking photos and did that. And I remember like getting to do a little bit of politics, and like Bertie Ahern had come in and you got to take the photos and quickly get it back to the office and send, and you know, seeing your pictures in the paper the next day, and I enjoyed that. But after doing it for about 7 or 8 months, the guy that had the small agency that I was working for decided to shut up shop and he was going to go back to England, and he saw a better opportunity for himself there. So that day I just kind of made a decision that I'd go to Dublin, and I got a job straight away with the Star, and then I started working for the Star, and within about 2 or 3 months of working with the Star, I got a phone call from somebody in the Irish Independent and asked would I come and do some features work for them. So for 3 years, I worked for the Irish Daily Star and the Irish Independent, doing a lot of their features for their supplements and stuff like that.
Okay, so I mean, did that satisfy you?
Oh, no. No, but what you realise is that if you can't go out to Finglas and cover a shooting in Finglas and have some 14-year-olds like in hoodies throwing stones at you, you have no right, or like, you know, kind of going out to anywhere where there's real conflict or there's real news stories and you're going to be covering those and reporting on those. I mean, like, if you want to, you know, make work for the BBC World Service or something, getting a job at one of the Red Tops in Dublin is one of the best educations you'll ever have. Yeah. It's a great starting spot, yeah.
Okay, so after a couple of years in with the Indo and, like, doing that, what was the next step?
The next step was I applied for a Simon Cumbers grant and I got awarded it, and I did a project in 2009, but because in 2008, when there was kind of like rumour of our boom to bust, all of a sudden in September 2008, sales in gold rose by 300% in Ireland, and people started to panic and take their money out of all the banks and started to buy gold, which is the safest place to put your money. So
does that not strike you and everyone here in hindsight as the most ridiculous thing? I remember having a taxi home with a colleague of mine in the paper. He's going to go nameless, and he was going, "I'm thinking about putting my money into gold." And I was going, "What? What do you know about gold?" I mean, when you say that, I'm thinking in hindsight it was the most maddest figgery anyone ever took.
They always said it's the safest bullion to put your money into. And the funniest thing about it is that gold is more rare than diamonds, you know? And so, India did something very smart, I think, about 4 or 5 years ago. And whatever reserves cash they had, they just bought all the gold. Yeah, so now if you want to go and buy some gold, you got to buy it off India, and they'll charge you a fortune for it, and they're keeping their money safe.
Yeah. Okay. So sorry for diverting you there, but that gold story always reminds me of that taxi ride and that conversation. So yeah. Where did gold lead you to?
So I was interested in where the gold came from that was on the stock market for Irish investors to buy. So I started doing a bit of research, and that led me to Ghana, to a particular gold belt in Ghana. And then I applied for Simon Cummer's grant. I got it, and they gave me some money to go out and to do the story about, you know, where the gold comes from in the illegal gold mining industry. And I went out to Ghana and I crawled down man-made holes like 250 feet below ground, and it was like kind of frightening but really exciting. And I remember like walking up the side of this mountain, and we must have been walking for about an hour and a half to 2 hours, and I mean, like, Ghana is a really humid country, and you know, we're sweating, and I'm like, oh my god, like, are we ever going to get to where we're going? And we're just following some guy that was about 17 years of age, and he's like, just come on. It was a bit like Schmeagle or something. We're like, where are we going? You're leading us nowhere. And then all of a sudden we just kind of like walked through the jungle, and there was a clearing, and there was maybe like, I don't know, 100 men on the side of a mountain digging away, and they're all there working away. And I arrived, and it's like, white girl in the middle of the jungle. And they came down and said hello. And of course, for a moment I was nervous, but then I ended up going back up there 2 or 3 times after that, and just kind of hanging out and hearing stories. And you know, many of them, their parents had worked in the gold mines, in the illegal gold mines. And then when they were young, and as soon as they could walk or talk, kind of were brought up there. And then, you know, as soon as they were strong enough, started working there. And that's how they make their living.
Okay, so yeah. Documenting that, what's that lead to then, Jean?
That led to a solo exhibition of the work in the joinery in Stony Batter, and it led to a front page and a double page spread in the Irish Examiner about the story.
Okay, right. Okay, so that obviously gave you a taste for kind of like documenting stories like that. Was that when you went to Haiti then?
Off the back of that, then I went to Haiti with Haven. Yeah. But those kind of things, you kind of get asked to go out and do those things, and you think, oh, it's going to be great, and I get to go around Haiti and I get to take some photographs, but you don't really, I mean, like, there's another agenda there. You're there, I was there, I think there was 5 journalists from different newspapers, and I supplied the images, I took all the images for all the newspapers, so it was hectic, and that was just before the earthquake.
Okay, before it?
Yeah.
Okay.
But after all of this happened, and after the earthquake, and after going to Ghana, I really knew that that's what I wanted to do. And so from there, then in 2010, I moved to Kenya and I moved to Nairobi because I wanted to work in international press. And so that's what I did.
Okay. So like we'll come back to Kenya and Nairobi in a bit, but I want to kind of move on to Afghanistan,
okay.
You know, and like mean the From Both Sides project, you know.
Okay.
So, like what was the, I suppose, the impetus in the first place to go to Afghanistan?
When I worked in Kenya, everybody was said to me, if you want to make it, you have to go to Afghanistan. That's where you go to make it.
And what's it defined by make it? Get your name known?
Yeah, like, I mean, because ultimately at the end of the day, what you want to do is, I suppose, like the goal is to be a contract photographer for either the New York Times, Time Magazine, or National Geographic. So they're the big ones. And, or the Washington Post. And
not the Examiner.
Not the Examiner. They just don't have the same, like, they just don't pay the same. So you want to be out there and you want to be doing it. But when I went out there and I met like people that were actually doing those jobs, I realized that it's a certain type of individual that does that job. And they're usually kind of a bit disconnected. And they're okay with living just out of like a little rucksack and moving from crap hotel to crap hotel to crap hotel, and seeing the worst things. And when I got out there, I really started to question whether I wanted to be a photojournalist. And I was surrounded by photojournalists, and I really was becoming very disillusioned by it. And I'd started working. I was also really interested in the whole piracy thing, which was really hot topic at the time. So I wanted to move to the coast, and I moved to the East Coast, and I ended up then covering the East Coast of Kenya for Agence France-Presse, Getty Images. And I saw how the images I used were being used, you know, in the newspapers. They go onto a newswire and they're available for news editors all over the world to buy and to use. So I mean, like, I could take a photograph and it could end up in Russia, Spain, America, England, wherever. And you really start to kind of question how your imagery is used. And I started at that stage, I started to go, you know, I'm not teaching anybody, I'm not learning it, you know, nobody's going to learn anything about the world from the images I use, because everybody already has their agenda and has already decided what the world looks like. So how can I think about this differently and what can I do? And so that then led me to going to Afghanistan.
Right. Like, I mean, essentially what you said there about, like, I mean, I suppose the photojournalists who work in kind of like war zones, you know, a couple of years ago we did a banter conversation with Mary Fitzgerald, ex of the Irish Times, now the Irish Independent, and Ed Bellamy from The Observer about war correspondence. It was quite an amazing, you know, and there's an amazing book by a guy called Anthony Lloyd called My Lovely War, I Miss It So, you know, and they talk about kind of like, I suppose, there's almost like a siege mentality that war correspondents go into, you know, and yeah. You talk there about this little gang. Do you think, I mean, sometimes when it comes to war correspondence covering places, and maybe especially with photographers because they have to get into positions, that there's a bit of kind of like the loose cannon about it, you know, that you have to be a little bit unhinged to do that?
Yeah, you do. Like, I mean, like, you look at what happened particularly in Libya, and, you know, so many photojournalists got injured or people lost their lives in really, really deadly mortar attacks, you know. And I mean, like, the nature of news has changed. Before, it used to be back in the days of like Vietnam, whatever, and you just have like press written on your hat and like TV written on your car, and it's like safe passage. Now you see with things like ISIS, where they're trying to create, you know, the biggest response from the actions that they take. So they utilize people who are not the target, but who are going to generate the biggest response from the public. And so they want to create a complicit community. So they will take somebody like a journalist or an English aid worker, and they will, you know, behead them in the most, you know, savage way, publicize it. And that is, you know, the journalist is not their target. Their journalist is the most effective way of getting a reaction from the target. And so you have, like, that didn't happen before, but war is lethal now, you know, so.
Okay, so in terms of your Afghan kind of, like, I mean, like, trip and your kind of project, did you know going out, like, I mean, what you were looking for? I mean, and like, how did you kind of, like, come across, I suppose, you know, what you did was you took photographs of US soldiers who were based in Afghanistan,
yeah.
And then you worked with a local artist. So maybe, like, talk a little bit about how you came across that idea in the first place.
Well, let me tell you something first. When you're a girl and you want to go to Afghanistan, nobody goes, that's a great idea. Yeah, nobody says that. It took me about 4 years to get to Afghanistan, and it was like, you know, never giving up, being determined that this was a really good idea, trying to explain the idea to people, and people going, well, the idea is not fully resolved. And I'm going, well, the idea won't be fully resolved until I make the work. And it's a really painstaking process. And after, the one thing that you need to get on military embed is a letter from a media organization saying that they're sending you there, and they're going to be responsible for the repatriation of your body in the event that anything happens, and that the news organization will contact your family and deal with your family. And nobody, after all the newspapers that I worked for, would give me this letter. And it was only that my partner, Shane Whelan, who runs this marketing advertising agency called Project, he was friends with the CEO of the Daily Mail, and he rang him and he was like, I need this favour. And he went, okay, well, if anything happens here, you're responsible. And Shane went, I'm willing to take responsibility. And if that had not have happened, I would never have made it to Afghanistan, because no one is going to open that door for you. Yeah. And so when I went out there, I knew I was going out with the intention of taking photographs of the military, because the picture of the soldier was the central narrative of the war in Afghanistan. If you Google conflict in Afghanistan, war in Afghanistan, and you do an image search, all you see is pictures of the armed forces engaged in combat. And you see very, very, very few pictures of Afghans, unless they're being approached by members of the armed forces. And so for me, looking at it, I went, the Afghan side of this conflict has been completely underrepresented. And it's really, really unfair. Osama bin Laden could never have imagined that, you know, by blowing up the Twin Towers, that it was going to, that the response would be a 13-year conflict in Afghanistan, you know, and that hundreds of thousands of innocent Afghan civilians would be killed, you know. And he was an Arab, you know, hiding out in Afghanistan. And so being very conscious of that, I wanted to use the soldier as the central as the central figure. And then I went out to the ISAF headquarters, which was where lots of the different militaries, they're based in Kabul, and it's like the most dangerous place you can go in Afghanistan. It's the number one target. And I went there, I took photographs of lots of different soldiers, and then I flew from Afghanistan to Dubai. I went into a dark room, I processed all the rolls of film, and I made the prints. But when I went to process the rolls of film, because of the X-ray machines and the amount of X-ray machines that you go through in Afghanistan and Kabul airport, a lot of the film was destroyed. So I'm like, go in Dubai going, oh my God, can I get any pictures? Can I get any pictures? Oh my God, this is ridiculous. And, you know, it was a really, really, really stressful time. So it took me, you know, 4 years to get there, and then I get out there and then I arrive in Dubai and I'm like, oh my God, now I haven't got any pictures. I'm never going to get the opportunity. But I managed to get pictures together, and I ended up, you know, spending a lot of time in the dark room and just put in a lot of hours there and managed to retrieve images. And then when I had the images, I flew back to Afghanistan with the intention of going to Herat in the west, where I was going to be working with some guys who used to paint portraits before there was colour film. People used to hand paint portraits.
Okay, so like, where, did you, as you come across this, this, obviously you'd come across this process before, how did you come across it? Was it a book?
I was researching hand-painted portraits in Afghanistan, and then I came across this image. Okay, I wanted to bring a little visual aid. So this image...
Okay, for the purpose of the podcast, that people might listen to afterwards, okay. It's basically, it's a picture of two people right side by side, two males.
And they're hand-painted. But the thing that really impressed me about them is how well they're painted and how neatly they're painted. And they look like photographs. And they're really, really beautiful. And there's like a lot of attention to detail on the man's blouse, on the man's shirt, and on his jacket. And just the way that the skin was softened, and even the way that they were positioned for the photographing. And a big thing as well is you know, the colours that you put behind somebody in the background, background colours when you're taking photographs. And I just thought that the person that took these really understood both photography and painting. And so while I was mid-flight from Dubai to Kabul, I remembered this image and I went, do you know what? I know this image was taken in a town called Mazar-e-Sharif. I'm going to see, can I go there and find the man that painted these pictures?
Okay, so how far is Mazar-e-Sharif from Kabul?
I flew there and it took about an hour.
Okay, an hour. So
I think it's 5-6 hours drive.
Right. What state is Mazar-e-Sharif in? Is it pristine? Is it in rubble? Is it in
between? Mazar-e-Sharif is a town in northern Afghanistan on the edge of the Hindu Kush Mountains. It is very conservative. It hasn't had a chance to kind of, you know, you go to Kabul and you see some girls and they're not really wearing a headscarf and they're wearing makeup and they're walking around the streets and kind of things like that. All the women in Mazar-e-Sharif are wearing a burqa. Because the tribe of people, the Hazari people, are kind of from that region, they were the most persecuted by the Taliban. And it was just would be a kind of one of the areas where there was a lot of the conflict was based, and there was a lot of Taliban strongholds. Like, everyone there has a story.
Yeah. Okay, so like, I mean, you went there with the purpose of tracking down, was the purpose of tracking down the person who painted that particular picture, or was it anyone?
The person that painted these pictures. I had a name taken studios, and I had a fixer. So I had somebody to help me on the ground, because you can't walk around Afghanistan on your own as a woman. Afghanistan's not there. And so when I arrived in Kabul, we were planning on getting a flight to Herat, and I got off the plane, and I met him, and I was like, look, I've got a feeling, I think we should go to Mazar-e-Sharif. And he was like, what? And I was like, get on the phone, ring everyone you know in Mazar-e-Sharif, ask them, do they know of Tegan Studios? And he was sort of ringing everybody, and somebody said to him, I think I know the guy you're talking about, he's a master at this. And so we were like, I was like, that's it, let's just go, I'm going to follow that lead. And we went there, and then it turned out that it wasn't the right guy.
you didn't think you were going to find the right guy first time out?
I don't know. Do you know what? I just didn't question it. I just was like, this is what we're doing. I have this one chance. And it felt like in my heart of hearts that finding this guy was the right thing to do. Yeah.
Okay, so you're in Mazar-e-Sharif, and you're going around. How long did it take you to track down Mohammed?
How long did it take me to track down Mohammed? We arrived in the evening the next day, and we'll probably leave at about 7 o'clock the next morning, and at about 12 o'clock in the afternoon, the driver that we were using, we looked over my shoulder, and I had these pictures saved on my phone, and he looked over my shoulder and he said to my fixer, he said, are they photographs? And he was like, yeah. And he was like, I know somebody, come along. And so we got into the car and we drove along. And the minute I saw Kareem, I just knew. And so the driver went out and said hello to him. And Kareem came back and he sat into the car. They tried to explain, you know, I was here and I wanted to make this art project. And I was looking for somebody to hand paint pictures. Can you do it? And he was saying, yeah, no problem. And I was there going, does he understand what we're talking about? And they were kind of explaining. And then I took out my phone and I showed him my phone. And he straight away went, they're my pictures. And I was like, brilliant. And so, remind you.
So what's his story then? I mean, like, you know, if did obviously he made a living doing this. So, like, what was it? Had he stopped kind of doing this process?
Well, during the civil war and the Soviet invasion, after the Soviet invasion, there was a civil war in Afghanistan. And from the civil war in Afghanistan, the Taliban kind of took power. And within the Taliban, don't like any crack, right? They are like they're intolerant.
Yeah, they're anti-banter. Yeah. They're clearly anti-banter.
Yeah, completely. So there's no music, there's no singing, there's no dancing, there's no painting, there's no nothing. And so his profession as a photographer and as an artist kind of had to basically wrap up. So when I spoke to him about it and what he had been doing, when we met him, he was running a very, very small little tiny little shop across the road from the Iranian embassy, and he would do people's passport photos for them when they were looking for passports and visas and that kind of thing. And so that's how he's been making his living. But he had 5 children, and it emerged over our conversations over the few days that he really resented the fact that he was an artist, and that, oh, you know, during a time of conflict, nobody talks about art. There's no room for artists, and there's other ways of making a living other than, you know, taking portraits and painting them, you know, and... Mm. And nobody cares.
Yeah, he had a lovely quote actually in an interview. You kind of said, he said, in times of war, there is no room for art.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you arrived then with these photographs of these soldiers, you know, and you explained to him what was involved, like was he up for it straight away, or was he resentful in any way because of American soldiers?
No, and that was a big thing because people had really questioned what was going to happen, that I was going to take these photographs and then hand them over to somebody. And my whole thing was that I wanted this kind of like third narrative to emerge. You know, it's easy for me to go in and create pictures of conflict and say what the conflict's about or whatever. But if you're to ask somebody who's been there through the entirety of the conflict, what do they want to talk about? And how are they going to respond to this? I mean, people were saying, oh, he could paint them like really bad and it's not fair to do in the soldiers. And I was like, I'm allowing him his voice. His voice can be whatever it is. I'm not going to edit it, whatever. So when he came along and I asked him, would he do it? He ran home, he got some paints. He hadn't painted in 30 years. These were the same paints he had. He'd saved them from when he used to go to Iran. He came back, he started, took them out. He started going through all the prints and he decided which one he was going to paint. And he started painting. And it was literally, he was like a child. And you could just see how absolutely delighted he was to have like paint on his fingers. And actually, I'll show you some of the paints, pictures. They've never been shown before, so this is an exclusive. But basically, what he did, was he covers the print in linseed oil, and then he gets oil paints and he blends the oil paints together with his fingers, and then he applies the oil paints all over the print. Then, through a series of like using cotton wool and his fingers, he removes the paint and he adds more and more and more paint. So this is the final product. So they're a little bit. They're all of different soldiers, and it's not about the nationality of the soldiers. It's about creating a body of work where I suppose these people are looking out at you, and each one is his own kind of like, I suppose, subjective experience of painting them. But in making the work, I asked him, you know, what did he want to talk about? And he wanted to talk about how nobody ever asks the artists, and how artists are the people that shape culture, that make a country, you know, and the culture and the society, and that comment on it in a way that, you know, many other people are not capable of commenting on, but that nobody ever went to Afghanistan and asked the artists, and nobody ever allowed the artists to have a voice. And so that's it.
Okay, so like, so once the project was done, then you came back to you come back to Ireland or go back to Dubai to like for the next step.
I then came back to Ireland. Oh, sorry, I forgot one very important thing. It turned out that this was his brother, and that he'd been killed by the Mujahideen in the early 80s. And so when I came home, I suppose I kind of thought about it, and I was like, this Irish girl rocks up in the back of a taxi and goes, can you paint this? And I show him a picture of his deceased brother. So when you kind of come away, you kind of think about those things. And that was something,
I mean, look, but obviously, like, that actually reminds me of another question. You know, I mean, as you're like working with Kareem then on this, like, did you stay in Masjid Sharif while it was all going on? So obviously you had lots of kind of conversations. Aside from talking about like how the fact that artists were kind of downplayed, like, what was his take on, like, I mean, the Taliban, that, like, I mean, what had gone on? What was his take as well on the kind of the American forces?
They didn't really go into that. What happened was is that between the driver, the guy who worked in the hotel, right, Kareem, who painted, and then the my fixer, Rahullah, they all started talking about their own experiences over the years. And Rahullah, my fixer, was from Kandahar, and he would talk about when, you know, things very first happened, and the Arabs who were based in Kandahar went to the mosque and went, the Americans are going to come and they're going to kill us. Will you please take care of our wives and our children? And the people in Kandahar, the Afghans, were like, no, look at what you're doing to our country. Look at the problems and the trouble you're bringing into our country. And he said that once it got dark, that he said, like, it was unbelievable. The Americans would come in, and he said, and they would drop bombs directly on the houses. And it was just like complete precision bombing. There was no mistakes being made, and the Arabs were being targeted. And so that was his experience. And he then went to Pakistan with his family as refugees. And then there was a lot of stories of, like, you know, different things when the Taliban had, you know, had, for the guy in the hotel, how the Taliban had gone into a wedding and kidnapped his father and his brother and other members of his family and locked them in a container and threatened to kill them. And only if there was a very small kind of hole at the top of the container, they managed to push his brother out, and his brother then went to tell people where they were, and the Taliban then brought everybody down and put them into Taliban jails down in the Helmand province, and having to go down and buy the family back, and the family having no money and this kind of stuff, and then all the families moving to Pakistan as refugees, you know, and this kind of thing, and about how they were persecuted. And for Kareem, it was just, he spoke about very much the difficulties of having five children in a place where, you know, you're being persecuted by the Taliban all the time and you have no way of making a living. And all anybody talks about for 30 years is survival. Mm. And he said, like, you know, conversation is just about survival.
But does he also talk about getting out?
How do you mean about getting out?
I mean, like, you said earlier on about, like, I mean, the current narrative around refugees, and, like, I mean, we see a lot of Syrians, we see a lot of Afghans in the multitudes of people getting trying to get into kind of Western Europe and a better life. Did he talk about anything?
No.
So no. He as far as he was concerned, he was at home and he wasn't going to be moved.
Yeah, I mean, like, he's 65 years of age. He's been there, you know, all his life. Before he used to travel to Russia, spent 2 weeks on a train to buy photo paper and travel back again, and, you know, and to try and buy chemicals, and he'd go into all the camera shops they possibly could, and he'd buy his paints and stuff in Russia, and it was a 2 week round trip on a train, and you know, and this is what he loved. But then, like I said, he began to resent it, you know. He resented the fact that he was an artist, and he, you know, that his father had been an artist and his uncle had been an artist and his brother had been killed, which I didn't kind of delve too much into, but I got the impression that it had to do with something with this small studio which they used to run. And yeah.
Okay. You said earlier on, like, I mean, about the narrative gene, you know, and that it's important to get the kind of, like, I suppose, the artist perspective on things. What about the soldiers? I mean, have you found out what the soldiers have thought of the kind of, like, of these new versions of themselves?
Yeah. Most of them are just like, cool.
Okay.
It's been a really nice.
So it's basically cool dude. It's not
There's like, they haven't really said too much. I mean, like, I suppose they kind of wanted to know where they were going to end up. And there's a couple of people in the British Armed Forces that have been really enthusiastic about it. And the work now is hopefully going to go and live in the Imperial War Museum in London. And if any of you have ever been to the Imperial War Museum, if you haven't been, go, because it's really, really amazing. And so they're very excited about the idea that, you know, a picture of them will be hanging on the walls, hopefully, in there. And
When's that going to happen?
These acquisitions take a long time, and so we're in talks, and so hopefully maybe the earliest it'll happen will be April, but it might be later than that.
Okay, so it'll be 2016. Okay, perfect. Yeah. Okay, so, like, I mean, what like the other, we mentioned earlier on about the other projects. I mean, there was a project, there was a very nice project you did with, like, a load of people from Malawi who'd moved to Ireland.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I did. I was doing a master's, and I ended up meeting this group of young Malawian students who all came from very well-to-do families in Malawi and had moved to Ireland, and I was interested in kind of making portraits of them in places. They'd gone through the same kind of transition that I went through when I moved to Kenya, where everybody straight away is like, oh, you're white, you're rich, you're working with an NGO, and I'm like, no. And people already have, like, you know, kind of very perceived notions of why you're there. And so they were living on the north side of Dublin, and look, they would just walk down the street and then, you know, incur lots of instances of racial abuse, or would be attacked or would be chased and this kind of thing. And it was really funny because, you know, one of them, like his aunt was Joyce Banda, the president of Malawi. You know, another one, his mother was like a, you know, a diplomat, and they were all just very well-to-do kids that came to Dublin to go to college, but yet believed that if you were black and in Ireland, everybody assumed that you were a refugee. Yeah.
And the other project as well, like it looks amazing. I'm really, I'm very curious about this one. It's the Shoreline cast.
Oh, right.
You know, this is the kind of like, I mean, going back to kind of a deserted Kenyan beach, you know.
Yeah.
And what really struck me about this was the colours, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, but like, talk to me about like how you found that particular beach and where it was.
That particular beach was off 10 kilometres outside a little town called Matuapa, where I had been living on the east coast of Kenya. And I'd been living in Matuapa because I was photographing a little Muslim girl called Suela and her family. And I really wanted to know about Islam and about, like, you know, whether there's Sharia law in certain parts of Kenya along the coast, because it's 98% Muslim. And so I kind of met this little Muslim girl, and I was just kind of fascinated by her. I think I like met her, and I was like, you know, there's something special about her, and I wanted to know about her life. And so I kind of followed her around the place and took photos of her. And then her family really ended up embracing me, and it was like five sisters and their kids and their husbands, and I just got to see what it was like as a Muslim woman living in a town where there was Sharia law, and some people were like, you know, a third or a fourth wife and this kind of thing. And and through there, then I just kind of go off and have a look around. But I came across this beach by the Juma Ruins, and it was originally, there was a massive slave port there. And there was big old ruins of where there was like colonial kind of castle at one point. And, you know, the Arabs came in, and they say it was like one of the first places that the Arabs landed. And then the British were there for a while. And anyway, all of those buildings are kind of in ruins now. But these fishermen go down there very, very early every single day and fish using the most like primitive techniques. And they go out and they swim. And these guys are like fish. They can stay underwater for so long without coming up, and they go down and they spear fish, or they just catch fish with their hands and they put them into nets. And so I was interested in looking at these men and I suppose how they make their livelihoods. And yeah.
Do you find it easy to establish trust with subjects?
That's a very difficult question, you know?
Good.
Yeah.
Like, because it also, no, like, you know, it's one of those questions I'm always curious about photographers, because I hate having my photograph taken. So when someone does a good job, I always kind of try to think, what do they do to actually get that right, and how do they make that connection? And in your case, you're dealing with people outside your culture, outside,
yeah,
like, I mean, your safety grounds. And like, how do you do it? Is it the case of the people you use in case of fixers, or is it the case of the conversation you have?
No, when I went to Afghanistan, that's the first time I've used a fixer. I suppose, you know, if you work with the BBC, or you're out in these places and somebody's working for like Time magazine or something, they come along and it's like Time magazine, and they've fixers and they've drivers and they've this and they've that, and everything is made as easy as possible for them to get their photographs. Me, I'd just be kind of like there with a bag of cameras and just kind of, you know, rock along. And I suppose people just kind of get used to seeing you, and they always think you're a bit mad, you know, and they're like, oh, that crazy white girl, you know. And then eventually they just, you know, just get used to you.
Yeah.
And it's a big time thing, you know, the way, yeah, you just, you know, the whole idea is to be present without being present. And that is a skill that you have to practice as a photographer. You want to be there, but you don't want your presence to be known within the photograph. You're trying to get that snapshot of what life is like without it being, you know, a show being put on for you being there or anything like that. And that means that you need to sit there, you need to be quiet, and you need to just let life happen. And that's it.
Okay, so what's the next project then for you, Jean?
The next project is, well, I'm working on two at the moment. One, I hopefully, is in a place called the Comoros Island, which is an archipelago of islands south of Madagascar. And it's basically looking at, so with the mass exodus of people leaving Syria and Iraq, and the Comoros Islands is an archipelago of four islands. And in 1991, one of the islands voted to stay under governance of its old colonial of France. And so it's a small republic of France. But the people from the other three islands have been using it as a backdoor to get into Europe for years. So in 2012, the president of Comoros, Grant, came out and addressed the UN General Assembly and asked for people to help them because what this 70-kilometer stretch of water from Comoros, Grant to Mayotte had turned into what he called the world's largest marine graveyard, with an estimated 15,000 people are after losing their lives. And nobody's really done anything about it. But the interesting thing about this place is that everybody's connected. They're all members of the same families. They speak the same language. They're the same religion. They're all the same. They're all the same ethnicity. And so I wanted to go and see what it was like, because this is one of the rare places where you can go. You can meet people from the families of people who have left. You can see where they've drowned, and then you can meet people who've made it to the other side, and so you can cover the full journey and you can see it. And so I'm interested in that, and also looking at the idea that there's a full generational loss, there's a full breakdown of their country, culture, and as a result of so many people leaving and so many people dying along the way, or getting to Mayotte and maybe making it to Europe, but it's just a complete breakdown of culture in place.
Mm. I mean, are you coming across many other stories like that? I mean, you say that's one that's not being covered, but surely there must be other stories that you've come across that aren't being covered involving migration of that kind.
Yeah.
Due to kind of like climate change or whatever.
Yeah, all over the world, really. You know.
You said two projects. What's the second one?
The second project is a project that I'm doing at home, which is kind of like looks at the role of, I suppose, the religion has played in the family album. And so I've been making it at home. I live in Waterford and I live in a cottage that was built in 1790 that my grandfather was born in, and his sister, his family, and they were raised, and it's on a farm. And my father was is a farmer, but he's in his 70s now, and he doesn't really farm anymore. And I'm kind of living on the land, and none of us are really going to farm the land. And I'm kind of looking at it, and I'm using a lot of old found images, a lot with a lot of more contemporary abstract photographs that I've been taking, and using as well the painted photograph and things like that to just kind of tell the story, I suppose, of time passing by, and also about, you know, every day at 12 o'clock, dinner was put on the table. It was Angela's, then dinner, then back out to the farm. And now there's like a more esoteric kind of way of life. And, you know, the role of the Angela's doesn't play so much. But, you know, in Islam, people always talk about the call to prayer. And we have a call to prayer here as well. It happens at 12 o'clock in the day, and it happens at 6 o'clock in the evening before the news. And I think that's really interesting, the fact that, you know, there's these ideas of like Catholicism and religion being lost within our lives. But yet it's still there, and it's still present in some ways. We just don't kind of maybe pay the same levels of attention to it. So, yeah.
Okay, excellent. Jean Curran, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Jean
Curran.
Thanks a million to Jean for taking the time to come to Dingle to join us at Banter. This podcast was recorded by Andy Wilson, produced by Banter series producer Tanya White, and made with the help of Molly King and all the other voices. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please rate us and spread the word. Tell your friends about us, recommend us on your favourite social media network, leave a review or a rating on the iTunes store, and don't forget to subscribe. Check out thisisbanter.com for news we're up to at Banter, as well as the back catalogue of Banter podcasts. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.